In this first part of Focus, we'll be talking about globalization. Now, this is something that we have discussed many times on the program before with people who think that it's a good thing and people who think that it's not. I think in most of these cases, the perspective has been a very much an American one, one from the perspective of the developed world. This morning, in this first part of Focus, we will have what I think is going to be a different perspective, at least different from that we presented before on the program. Our guest is Walden Bellow. He is director of Focus on the Global South. He's also a professor of public administration and sociology at the University of the Philippines. He's visiting the campus to give a talk, the first in a series, a sort of interdisciplinary initiative that's sponsored in part by the Center for Advanced Study, looking at globalization. His talk will be held this afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Levis Center on the U of I campus. And certainly anyone who is listening and can attend should feel welcome. It's open to the public, as all of the center events are, almost all of them are. And of course, in here on the program, we're interested in your comments and questions as we talk. You're certainly welcome to call in. All we ask of callers is people just try to be brief, and we ask that so that we can get in as many different people as possible, keep things moving along. But anybody is welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. At any point here, you're certainly welcome to call. Focus on the Global South is based at Chulalongkorn University in Bangkok. Am I getting anywhere near the correct pronunciation?
Oh, yes. It's Chulalongkorn University. It's in downtown Bangkok, Thailand. And yes, we've been there for about 7 years now.
So you divide your time between the Philippines and Thailand?
Yes, I teach in the Philippines. I'm a professor at the University of the Philippines, and I am managing this institute in Bangkok. And it's actually not that far by air. It's about 2.5 hours. So, it's a manageable sort of trans-border work.
Well, maybe I might ask you to talk for a minute about Focus on the Global South and what your interests are.
Oh, well, we set ourselves up mainly to look at economic, political, and ecological trends in the Asia-Pacific region. And especially, we were very alarmed by the way that in the 1990s, indices of inequality and poverty were rising instead of falling, and that the incidence of political conflicts globally were also rising. And the focus came out of a sense that the processes of what we call corporate-driven globalization was not, in fact, creating the sort of smooth transition to prosperity for the South that, or the third world, or the developing world that had been promised, but instead was creating a very conflictive type of situation. So we've, as an institute, we've looked at, the economics of development, and the role of multilateral international institutions like the World Bank, the IMF, and the World Trade Organization, the role of trade. We've looked at security-related issues like conflicts and civil wars and the rise and military deployments and the spread of nuclear weapons. And then we've looked at areas that we might call areas of cultural conflict, including why, for instance, we ask, has there been such a rise and an increase in the popularity of what we might call Islamic extremist movements that many people have been discussing. But to look at these issues so that we, not to look at them in a simplistic sort of fashion, but to gain an understanding of them, the sort of understanding that unfortunately you don't get in CNN, you don't get in Time, you don't get in Newsweek, and which is a pity in the sense that so much of the understandings of what's happening in the developing world is oftentimes filtered through this media that are, corporate-controlled media. Just CNN is part of this large conglomerate, the AOL Warner combine. Mm-hmm. But I think what's happened is indeed what we're trying to do is present an alternative analysis, especially to people in the South, in the developing world, about many of these developments.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk generally about globalization, because as I say, we've certainly talked about it quite a bit on the program, mm-hmm. with people who feel that the end result will be that everyone will be wealthier. It's mm-hmm. It's the rising tide lifting all the boats, mm-hmm. kind of theory. Mm-hmm. And also those people who have argued that at least to date, what has happened in many cases is that it has the wealthy people and the wealthy nations have gotten wealthier, mm-hmm. and the poorer people and the poorer nations have gotten poorer. And that has been a direct result of economic globalization. Tell me, for the place that you live, for the region that you live, what globalization you think has meant.
Well, before 1997, the Asia-Pacific region was known as the area of the tiger, the roaring tiger economies. These were supposed to be the economies that were the most globalized, in the developing world. There was supposed to be, fewer and fewer obstacles in the form of barriers to trade. A lot of the barriers in terms of flows of capital had been removed. Then in 1997, precisely because of financial globalization, the money that had come in very quickly to take advantage of investment opportunities left, about $100 billion left in the course of a few weeks. And since there were no checks on the outflow of capital because of the ideology that financial globalization was great, we had all of those economies collapse. So the region has not recovered from the so-called Asian financial crisis. It went through about 2 years of recession. And just as it was about to lift off, over the last few months, then you have the collapse of Wall Street here and the crisis of the U.S. economy. Now, I think that the reason that's important is because so much of the recovery in Asia was being premised on a continuing boom in the U.S. economy. So what does globalization in effect mean for many people these days? It has meant uncontrolled financial flows, collapsed economies, and synchronized downturns. Synchronized meaning synchronized recessions, meaning East Asia, Japan, the United States, and Europe are all entering a period of economic stagnation. So if you basically one of the lessons here is that the more and more you integrate yourself into the world economy, the less and less protections you have, the more and more you make yourself vulnerable to this sort of global downturn, so that instead of your economy or different areas of the world economy sort of being a countercheck to say, recessionary tendencies in the United States, you all get affected in the same direction. So the face of globalization at this point is, in fact, this synchronized downturn, downspin globally that you are seeing basically unfolding in the global economy at this point.
I know that there are some people, and again, I think one hears this both from people who think that globalization is positive and those who think that it's negative. One thing that it seems and often that all of those people agree on is that it's inevitable. And I wonder whether you think that that's true.
No, even the Economist magazine, which is one of the proponents of globalization, has said that it's reversible. The trend towards increased liberalization of trade, deregulation, privatization can be reversed. So it's not inevitable. I think that this is one of the things that has gone out of the window, the inevitability of this process. But I think that globalization is such a word that's thrown around so much. And but for me and for any other people, when we talk about globalization, we really are talking about corporate-driven globalization. This is the integration of national economies into the global economy, mainly under the aegis or under the push of transnational corporations. Basically, we're talking about a process whereby production throughout the world becomes more and more integrated, not in a sort of benign way that's determined by citizens and planned, but in order to be able to fill the needs and a process driven by the needs for profitability of transnational corporations, and which is really a process that is not driven by social needs. Okay, so this is what we oftentimes mean by globalization. So when people talk about anti-globalization activists, what they really mean is people who are against a certain kind of integration under the aegis of transnational corporations that are that is happening in the world economy. That's what I would say. That's the sort of process that has really now become identified as the globalization process. So that when people ask me, "Are you against globalization?" I say yes, but at the same time, I would be for a very healthy international economy. I would be for a very healthy interaction among national economies in the international sphere. So another way of putting it is that international cooperation among economies is something very desirable. But corporate-driven globalization, which means corporations drive the process, not people, not citizens, that is what we're against. So I think this is important to establish this because oftentimes people who are critical of globalization are said to be anti-trade. They are said to want to go back to some pristine past. They're said to not appreciate the complexity of the global economy. Of course, we all appreciate that, but there's integration and there's integration, so that we usually use the word globalization as opposed to denote one type of coming together at a global level as opposed to what I would call internationalization, to use that word, whereby economies join together in the world economy, but not in a way that they lose capacity or their strength is sapped, or but in joining in the world economy, their local capacities are also increased. That's the sort of healthy interaction with the world economy that you do not find under corporate-driven globalization. So we're all for, definitely we're all for international interaction through trade and other means, but what rules? and who determines the process. Those are really the key things that count. And that's sort of the way that we really need to pitch the debate at this point, because the, oftentimes the way that this globalization, anti-globalization debate has gone in the past is that the meanings of the terms themselves have become quite confusing. So I think I needed to make that point, because I'm just as much of an internationalist, say, as some other people, but I would not be a globalist. If we then make sure that we know what those terms mean.
Let me introduce again our guest for anyone who might have just tuned in the last little bit. We're speaking with Walden Bello. He's director of Focus on the Global South in Bangkok, Thailand. It's a program of Chulalongkorn University's Social Research Institute. He is also professor of public administration and sociology at University of the Philippines. He's here visiting the campus to speak on this very topic as part of now what will be a year-long initiative, interdisciplinary initiative. People will come here, speak from different perspectives, all about globalization. A number of sponsors for this, but perhaps chief among them is the Center for Advanced Study on the U of I campus. Our guest, Professor Bello, will be talking this afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Levis Center on the U of I campus. Anyone interested should feel welcome to attend. The questions are also welcome here on this program. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. The forces on the side of economic globalization that's driven by transnational corporations, including, I think we'd have to include the governments of the countries of the developed world, the United States and Europe and so forth. That's all on one side. They all have very strong voices and a great deal of power to drive the trend in the direction that they want to go. There are people who are speaking out on the other side, people who would, like you, say that they're interested in internationalization more than globalization, as you have defined it. Sometimes I think it's a little confusing, because the forces, the anti-globalization forces, I think don't often speak with one voice, because they are made up of different groups of people that have perhaps slightly different agendas. What would it take, do you think, to at least have the voices for internationalization be as strong as the voices for globalization? Is that really possible?
Oh, yes. I think, first of all, diversity is a sign of strength. And, we don't all speak with one voice, although our larger perspectives are the same. And, I think that's a sign of strength. Precisely one of the problems in terms of the globalization model has been that there's this sense that there's only one way to development, and that's by letting the market have its say and not controlling it, and that by having unrestricted liberalization, deregulation, and privatization, that sort of market-driven type of development model has been, in fact, a very doctrinal one. It's a one-shoe-fits-all model. And precisely what we have said is that one of the things that the globalizers and the old communist doctrinaire share in common was that they believed that there was one universal model through which all societies needed to pass. You know, one was state socialism, the other is the market, the market model. First of all, diversity is really key. Said that, I think that we share common critiques on the role of transnational corporations, that basically, and this is very strong, that a lot of the problems that we're facing at this point, both in terms of, you know, greater inequity, greater ecological disequilibrium, is because of the tremendous power of transnational corporations. Second thing that we share is that the World Bank, the IMF, and the World Trade Organization are in fact setting rules of global governance that promote the interests of transnationals rather than promote the interests of peoples. And I think this is, you know, if you look at the World Trade Organization, it is, you know, basically the most powerful actors here are transnational corporations, either U.S. or Europeans, and they're the ones who are rewriting the rules on trade. They're the ones who are rewriting the rules so that they would ban or illegalize or render unlawful policies that would aim at to provide developing countries with an protection so that they can develop industrial capacity. All of, you know, that sort of what we would call the use of trade policy for development has now been outlawed. And so there is a shared analysis, you know, between, say, southern movements and northern movements about the problems that have been spawned by transnational corporations. We do not always share the same analysis, however, on solutions. For instance, some people would say that it would be important to for there to be a different WTO, you know, that you still need a sort of centralized body like the World Trade Organization that imposes one set of rules, but that what we would need is a different set of rules. And others that would say, well, the problem itself is the creation of centralized global bodies, that what you really need is not to have these centralized bodies like the IMF and the WTO controlling, you know, trade and finance, but you have to give space. You have to have the focus more on regional and national initiatives and not sort of have this process stifled by rules imposed by one global body. So there's a debate there that's happening. Another debate, for instance, is labor unions in the United States would, for instance, want to, some of them in the past wanted to push what was called the labor clause, which is that to make among the WTO be an arbiter of whether or not goods should enter the United States. One major consideration should be that they are, you know, they're not produced under conditions of labor that are not acceptable. This is the so-called social clause, and the WTO would be sort of a body that would determine whether or not goods were produced under ethical conditions or not. Whereas people in the South, in the developing world, basically said, well, no, I mean, this is, we share the same criticisms of the way transnational corporations use cheap labor abroad. But if you're going to make the WTO assume this role of deciding whether or not certain goods from the South can enter and not, or not enter because of the conditions of production, then you're giving even greater power to the World Trade Organization instead of whittling down that sort of power. And why don't you give that power instead to a body like the International Labor Organization? So, in other words, I think there's a healthy debate happening in terms of alternatives. And we're trying to engage people in both the South, developing world, and in the North around this debate on alternatives. This is the sort of this is where debate and diversity, you know, become much more attractive than the sort of you know, the sort of prescriptions that are purely ideological that are coming out of the established corporations and the World Bank and the IMF or the Bush administration on questions of trade and finance. So I don't think we need to apologize for the diversity of our views, because we do feel that it is only in a process of discussion and debate that we can in fact come up with what are appropriate alternatives. The last point I would just like to say is that in the long run, each of our countries, each of our economies will have to figure out what is the appropriate mix of policies so that it can build up capacity and develop rather than following one prescribed model, which is pushed throughout the developing world, like the IMF pushed this so-called free market model. Countries should be able to be the ones to, in fact, structure their economies the way that would be most appropriate for their needs, for their objectives, and for their rhythms as societies. So in short, as opposed to the what we call the monoculture of corporate-driven globalization, we are promoting a perspective that is based on respect for diversity.
We are just a bit past the midpoint here, and again, I should like to introduce my guest. We're speaking with Walden Bellow. He is a sociologist. He's professor of public administration and sociology at University of the Philippines. He's also director of Focus on the Global South in Bangkok, Thailand, a project of Chulalongkorn University's Social Research Institute. He's here visiting the campus, going to speak on this very subject on globalization as part of a year-long interdisciplinary initiative looking at this from different points of view. And I expect we'll have probably a lot of the speakers from the series here on the program, sponsored in part by the Center for Advanced Study on the campus. He'll be talking about globalization from below, the World Social Forum. That's the topic of his talk this afternoon, 4 o'clock on the U of I campus in the Levis Center. Anybody's interested is welcome to attend. And of course, questions, comments are welcome here. 333-9455. That's for Champaign Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. As you said a little a bit ago, I think it's true. When we go back to thinking about the Cold War, its economic dimensions, it was said to be a struggle between two economic systems, between state socialism and between market capitalism. And if we acknowledge the fact that the market has, the invisible hand has not always been free to act, certainly governments in the developing world have not been hesitant to be involved in the economy when they felt that that was appropriate. But at any rate, if we say that's what was going on, and then some people would argue that when the Soviet Union collapsed, that said, well, the war is over, capitalism won, state socialism lost, and now we know what's the best, the economic, political form to organize along. And so people, again, make the argument that the market's is the way to go. If we're saying, well, we're not sure that either of those two are the way to go, and respecting the comments that you just made about the fact that we don't want to say that there is then, if we say there's a third way, we're going to say there's only one, that individual nations have to sort of figure out for themselves how they want to go. How does one think about economics then in some sort of way that's neither of the two? It's neither an economy that's completely state, you know, where there's central control, but it's also not let the market rip kind of economy either. I mean, where is the mid ground there?
Well, this is a very interesting question, because just as a historical background, yes, in 1989, 1990, 1991, there was a great deal of triumphalism in Washington, in what we now call the capitalist world, that state socialism had collapsed, and that made people very complacent. That now the one model of market the market model or the free market model, which in the third world or the developing world was known as structural adjustment, that basically there were a lot of assumptions that it was in fact the only way out. And then people woke up in the late 1990s, with all the indicators practically pointing in the other direction, and with tremendous alienation and protests and crisis after crisis, like, for instance, the Asian financial crisis was followed by the Russian financial crisis, the Brazilian financial crisis. And ever since 1997, you've had just this series of crises, the latest of which is, of course, the crisis, the collapse of Wall Street. In other words, and of course, a very, very important milestone here was the Seattle collapse, the collapse of the World Trade Organization ministerial in Seattle, which I think was the, this series of events culminating in Seattle finally brought home to the establishment that all was not well, and that in fact things had spun out of control. And speaker after speaker, defender after defender of the establishment began to turn around, like Joseph Stiglitz, formerly chief economist of the World Bank, Jeffrey Sachs, formerly one of the stalwarts of what were called shock therapy in Eastern Europe, began to desert and say, no, basically the critics have been right. The sort of promise of the new liberal economy or the neoliberal economy has yielded disaster instead of positive results. So I think I just wanted to put that by way of background, that in fact, you've had 10 years from triumphalism to crisis. And now you have a situation which is, as they say, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. If you now have a global recession that's spreading, okay, and you have all the indicators showing, or most of the indicators showing, that this is going to be a long recession, okay, call it double dip or whatever, it's just that, this combination of corporate fraud, after all, a product of deregulation, and overcapacity has created a situation whereby you have an economic downturn that might last for some time, if not grow worse, then you now have a situation whereby the liberal model or the free market model has lost a lot of credibility. Okay. So you've had two models which have lost credibility. And now what we're saying basically is countries should be given that space to make their appropriate mixes of the market and the state. But beyond just sort of the state and the market, we're saying that in all of these countries, you should have civil society, citizens groups, intervene directly in the economic decision-making process, so that you really have three major actors operating. You not only have government and the market, you also have organized civil society, So what we are saying is that we agree on the principles, that should govern both the local and the global economy. But the way that these principles get applied really should be determined by this creative interaction between state, the market, and civil society in this particular economy. So what we're saying is that we need we need global governance, we need institutions that will allow and give that space, whereby countries can in fact determine what is best for them in this global economy. that's really what many of us are saying at this point, is the creation of space. Mm-hmm. Okay, we're not out to demonize the state. We're not out to demonize the market. We're just basically saying is that the mixes, the policy mixes of market and state, should be determined by economies and countries, rather than imposed on them by doctrinal people, whether those doctrinaires come from the left or they come from the right.
We have a caller to talk with. Let's do that. In Champaign, on line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Mr. Bello, would you agree that this discussion is sometimes carried on, perhaps particularly in this country, between false alternatives? That is to say, just as socialism, actually existing socialism was never quite what the socialists said it was, so actually existing capitalism is never quite what the capitalists say it is. I worry about this when we hear things about market solutions and so forth in a discussion of neoliberalism as a market model. Mm-hmm. I mean, isn't it the case that it's a market model, but it's a highly controlled market? When we talk about things like the North American Free Trade Agreement, there really isn't free trade there. It's corporate-driven trade that the agreement is really an agreement that privileges large corporations and establishes, as it were, privileges for investors. So that to talk about market models and free trade is already to engage in a kind of code that has to be decoded, particularly, I think, in an American context.
Yes, I certainly agree. I think a more appropriate word for trade, for free trade, should be, you know, corporate-driven trade, or so that the word free trade, I think oftentimes gives the wrong connotations, that it is sort of a process that benefits, you know, the large majority of people, whereas in fact free trade is indeed something that benefits principally transnational corporations. So there is a semantic problem that we face with terms like this, that indeed, and I think in any discussion we really need to clarify the fact, as what I've been trying to do right now, that the sort of deregulated trade or trade that is free of government intervention is not, in fact, leading to the sort of trade that benefits the majority of the population, but in fact benefits mainly, you know, a very small elite of transnational corporations. Yes, I think your point is very well taken when it comes to this.
And doesn't the phrase market economy have the same problem?
I would say that if in the discussion we have we know what are the terms that we're using, that clearly when you talk about the United States, to say that it is a market economy, you're definitely right. That is sort of a half-truth, because the full truth of the matter is that this is an economy that is in fact controlled for the most part by, you know, a relatively few transnational corporations. So I would say that the more appropriate term is a corporate economy rather than a market economy. Wouldn't you agree?
Hello? That's true. That's true worldwide too, wouldn't you say?
Right. Yes, definitely. It's just that in a market you have unequal actors. This is really the problem, that in both the national market and in the international market, you do not have actors that exercise the same sort of power in the market. Some actors are more powerful than others, and I think that this is in fact in a situation where the market operates with very unequal actors, you have very unequal outcomes. And this is so that I would say that this marriage between a few corporations and the market is what has in fact created or led to the sort of very unequal outcomes, both in this country as well as internationally.
I think in the United States we try to pretend that marriage never took place, too.
Yes, this is the problem, because in economics classes, people talk about the market and discuss it and that sort of thing without it being located in an institutional context where, in fact, you have unequal players in a market. And that is the tragedy that whether in the United States or in my part of the world, economics as a so-called science is very much divorced from the way that the economy actually functions and is dominated by powerful actors.
We just have about 6 or 7 minutes left. I hope that the caller will forgive me because I have another caller I want to get in, and we're getting to the point where we're rather short on time. And I do also want to introduce again one more time for anyone who might have tuned in, our guest, Walden Bello. He's a professor of public administration and sociology at University of the Philippines. We'll be speaking on some of these topics later on the U of I campus, and I'll give that information again one more time before we finish up. I do want to get on to our next caller here. This person is in Urbana on line number 2. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I read an article recently, and in the article they argue that, in fact, globalization is not as corporate-driven as most people think, or at least the evidence shows that it's really very, very few corporations who actually have multi-country facilities, where I expect what they're talking about is where they own the facilities. They've actually invested in a plant in Thailand or wherever. And they say that the argument was that very, very few multinationals actually engage in that kind of investment. And since that was one of the ways which it was hoped that the developing countries would gain power, because as the multinational invested more and more money in plants and facilities, you know, eventually they would have a little bit more power in this tug of war between the corporation and the workers. I think it's an important. I'm wondering, is this an indication that the multinationals are no longer investing in the developing countries, and they're merely making, I assume, contracts with existing facilities? And is that something that you too see as a very important development?
Well, I think direct foreign investment is still by transnational corporations is still a very, very powerful driving force, and the relocation of facilities, especially labor-intensive facilities of transnational corporations from the developed world to certain parts of the developing world is in fact taking place still. Now, the one of the problems, of course, here is that much of foreign investment is going to a few selected areas of the developing world, and among those is China. China is now become practically the workshop of the world. I think in 1 year it got about $48 billion annually of foreign investment coming from all sources, and which is a really huge chunk. I think about 1/4 of all investment in the developing world at this point, I could be wrong, is goes to China. That's the first thing. So foreign investment is still a very vital force, but it is going to a select number of countries. The second thing is, I think, yes, contractual relationships in which basically Nike, for instance, has contractors in Indonesia, Korea, different parts of the developing world, and it sets the standards. It's it gives the specifications and then basically tells people it's up to you how to produce this. That is very attractive, as Naomi Klein has written in her book No Logo. That is a very attractive sort of way of producing, because then the transnational corporation does not have to worry about labor conditions, that basically it skips that responsibility by basically telling contractors, well, you take care of it. Don't even tell us about how you produce this. We don't want to know. Just produce the specification. So this is the contractual production is very popular, because precisely it avoids many of these human and labor rights issues. So the third thing is in terms of the dominant transnational corporations, I think you have European, you have American principally, and then you have Japanese, and then you also have now emerging transnational corporations from selected third world countries. So I would say that in terms of the concentration of production, that is in fact that is taking place in just a few hands. So I would say that that concentration, investment, and production are going hand in hand at this point.
I think we're at the point here that we're going to have to finish up, because we're here coming to the end of the time. For people who, however, are in and around Champaign-Urbana, you do have an opportunity to hear some more from our guest, Walden Bello. He'll be speaking on many of these same themes, I'm sure, in a talk titled Globalization from Below, the World Social Forum. That's this afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Lavis Faculty Center on the U of I campus, and it is certainly open to anyone who is interested in attending. Our guest, Walden Bello, is professor of sociology at University of the Philippines and is also executive director of Focus on the Global South, based at Chulalongkorn University in Bangkok, in Thailand. Well, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate you giving us some of your time.
Thank you very much, Steve.